There comes a time in every manager's tenure when the fans collectively realise that the man in charge is simply not up to the job. Have we reached that point with Paul Clement? That's one of the many questions we'll get to the bottom of in episode 171 of the Tyler Stem Podcast with your host Mark Mayo, as per usual. And joining me on the other end of the line is Simeon Pickup, aka Bucks Royal, editor of the Tyler Stem. How is it going, Sim?
Just about hanging in there after seemingly a very good first half, but then Reading reverting to type in absolutely typical form in the second half. I'm just about getting over it, but we'll see.
And while Paul Clement isn't so fussed on bringing through the academy into the first team, we have our very own Tyler Stent Academy in the works here. And Matt Lawrence, a.k.a. Panners and Nutmegs, as he's known online and on Twitter, is joining us for his debut on the show. How is it going, mate?
I'm all good, thank you very much. Got my weekly dose of Reading disappointment. So aside from that, all good.
Well, that tends to be a bit of a running theme on the show, whether you're just listening to it or having to plan and produce and edit it. It does kind of grate a little bit as we go. And, you know, it's a bit of a weird one this week because I remember a couple of weeks ago we had that dismal Norwich showing, which by the time the show came around, we'd actually beaten Hull. But this time we've got two lovely dismal showings to get our teeth into, complete consistency, and that will be in the recap.
View from the Tarhurst End. Recapping this week's championship action.
So, one win in five, having led three times in those games and levelled up with a short time remaining versus Norwich as well. And, well, Reading, they're back in relegation form and back in relegation worries. Just one goal in terms of goal difference separating the Royals from the drop zone at the moment. And that QPR 1-0 defeat at home before the 4-1 defeat against West Brom. And guys, I think because the QPR game was quite a long time ago now, we'll have to sum it up in a short sentence, knowing full well that the sort of analysis that we're going to get into in West Brom is quite relevant for that as well. So, Sim, I'll go to you first then. How can you sum up that QPR performance in a short sentence for me?
I can do it in two words. Opportunity missed. After some really good performances in the last couple of weeks, really encouraging stuff at Preston, getting the win, a win at Hull, against Hull as well. And then getting that really good point against Brentford as well. It just needed us to take the initiative against QPR and just do ourselves justice, basically. That was a team that we could have gone out and beaten if we just played our normal game, to be honest, at least what we'd shown in the last couple of weeks. But we didn't do that. We allowed the same bad habits to get back into our mind, back into our play, and the whole thing suffered because of that.
Yeah, it seems a reasonable way of putting it. I think for me, it would be made them look good. And the fact that QPR, I'll never believe that QPR are a good team, but the way they've come this season, I knew that they weren't going to be a very good team. And I thought in the attack, they did okay, QPR, but in defence, they were very beatable. And we just made their defence look quite decent when we really shouldn't have. So, Matt, where do you sum up that QPR game?
I think one of the biggest problems is just the fact that we got outshot by QPR in terms of goals on target at home. I mean, we've gone to Brentford away and West Brom this weekend and outshot two teams that are very good football teams for this level. But then we've gone back to the Medeski and been outshot by a team like QPR, only getting one shot on target in 90 minutes. And really at home, that just isn't good enough.
It's interesting you mentioned the shots then, because moving swiftly forward to the West Brom game, and I mean, my tag will be down to have a look at the stats while I was working at home on Saturday at half time of the West Brom game, and it was the polar opposite of what I thought was going to happen. And if we can just focus on that first half to begin with, Reading absolutely hammering West Brom at the Hawthorns. I think it is about 14 of their 15 shots that they made in the 90 minutes were made in that first half, and it sounded like the fans there were very entertained, and it just sounded so much better, Matt, but we couldn't take our chances.
No, I think one of the big things was having Bodvarsson missing there. I mean, we've got one of the strikers with the best shot conversion rates in the league at 38.5%, which is only bettered by Billy Sharp at Sheffield United. Having him out was a big miss, and potentially if one of those chances fell to him, he could have been more clinical than those on the pitch at the time.
Yeah, that Bodvarsson thing, he was injured in the warm-up against QPR, for anyone who kind of missed that, because there were fans in the stadium behind me for the QPR game who had no idea why he wasn't playing, having been named in the lineup. And Baldock's another one that's out at the moment. I think Bodvarsson is a good finisher, but it's probably not the thing that I would say was best about his game. And the players that won the pitch, the chances that we created, there's still enough there, surely, to go. And, you know, you've got to take your chances away to these big teams. And West Brom are a very decent team this year.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree that Bodvarsson isn't necessarily a really good finisher, but at the moment he's in a purple patch, or at least he was before he was injured. His confidence was very high. He was getting into the right positions and just having the confidence to finish them off nicely. They weren't particularly good goals. They weren't 20-yard volleys or anything like that, but just the kind of simple goals that a confident striker does. And you compare those goals that he has been scoring with a really good chance that Mark Minolti missed on Saturday. One where he's kind of through on goal just in the channel. He's not too central. It's not a really easy chance, but if a striker in confidence or on confidence just sets himself properly and hits it first time or with one touch, then it goes into the bottom corner. But it's his first start in the league against a very tough side away from home, and you do just feel that he lacked that bit of confidence, that little bit of killer instinct that Daddy Bodvarsson has had in the last couple of weeks.
Why were Reading so good in that first half? Because we moved back to a 5-3-2, which, I mean, it matched up or seemingly matched up to a large extent with what West Brom had. Didn't have the sort of width or the pace down the flanks that Reading have, you know, got in abundance, certainly on the bench. They had Josh Sims and Mo Bow on the bench. What was the good thing? What was the reason that Reading managed to come out in that first half and actually play pretty well?
I think tactically we were just we got it spot on, to be honest. It was a really good way of just matching West Brom up, as you say. And that system allowed us to have enough players all over the pitch, to be honest. If they're playing wing-backs, you don't necessarily need two players out wide on each side yourself, because then you'll get overrun through the middle. We had three guys at the back centrally, three in the centre of midfield and two up top. And that just meant that whether we were defending, going through the middle or trying to put pressure on up top, we always had enough men in those positions. You go back a couple of weeks to when we were getting overrun in the middle because we were going 4-4-2 at home or 4-4-2 away from home. And those days are very much gone now, to be honest. We've got a good midfield three in Ezra Talahi, who brought a lot of balance, a lot of composure to the midfield on Saturday, as he has done before. Bakuna giving us a lot of energy, and John Swift giving us a lot of creativity as well. He seems a lot more confident, a lot more decisive than he did last season when he was struggling with injury. And that setup just really seemed to work. Even Tyler Blackett coming in a back three. He's been out for a couple of games now due to injury, and he just slotted in very well. And even Mate and McNulty up top as well. A new strike pairing for us in the league, but it worked well. So credit to Clement for having the bravery to change things up away at West Brom in such a tough game, but at least for 45 minutes it paid off.
And yeah, that brings us pretty nicely onto what happened. And what I think a lot of Reading fans are very frustrated by this. I think it's a scoreline, really. The result, losing at West Brom, probably the manner of it as well, is very important for a lot of fans. And perhaps if this comes in a season when you're mid-table and your team kind of is a bit inconsistent, wins, loses, win, loses, whatnot, I think it's probably just about one of those that you can say, oh, well, we'll try again next week. It's not so much of a problem. But for this result to come so soon after, I think a lot of fans were annoyed that Reading dropped the 2 points at Brentford. Obviously, the QPR game and the Norwich game as well is quite fresh in people's minds as well. It fits a pattern. And I want to work out exactly why Reading lost this game, because 4 goals in the second half is, let's face it, it's pretty dismal. But for that to start, you need the first goal. And the first goal, it's hard to pin down that this was necessarily a tactical problem, that this was a mental problem. This is just a quite simple ball into the box that Ilori doesn't deal with, and more importantly, Sam Walker doesn't deal with at all. And Matt, I wonder if you think that the first goal, I mean, without that, the game changes so much, and yet it's just such a bad one to watch back in the highlights over and over. There's nothing good about Sam Walker's abilities in that first goal.
Like you say, it's really just a ball tossed into the box, stood up at the back post. And I mean, if Sam Walker's positioning slightly better on that, he should just come and claim it, and there's no issue there at all. But like you say, we've gone 1-0 down, 1-1 from there. And the mistakes start creeping in again. Reading have had a real tendency to roll over the past however long, dating back to Stam's tenure as well. And it really looked like there'd been a change in the tide of that as well with the Brentford performance. We looked a little bit nastier, a little bit tougher. Like, we had a bit more grit within the side, but it appears that that's kind of a blip in the sea, really.
This, I mean, balls into the box. It sounds so simple that you can deal with these sort of things, Sim, but six out of the last seven goals we've conceded this week have just been balls into the box. West Brom are a good team. Give them a sniff and they will take it. And we gave them far too much of a sniff. And the marking from... It seemed like a zonal marking system, and that's what I've been told about the people that were at the game, saying it was a zonal marking system. There were no men on the post, which I suppose in itself is zonal marking, but we'll forget that. But the thing that people want to see is men on the post, man marking for the rest of the time, and that kind of does itself. But we allowed markers to get free, and I think the third goal I'll just about allow because it was a good finish, but the second and fourth ones, pretty abysmal to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And in scenarios like that, whether it's a ball in the box or just any kind of 50-50, anything that you might be able to deal with, you need a defender in there who's going to take charge, someone who's going to organise the defence or just yell at someone to get them organised or just do the simple stuff, basically. And against Hull, that was John O'Shea. He just made everything look simple. He didn't try anything overly elaborate, but you could tell that he brought a kind of experience and the leadership to that defence that typically we otherwise haven't had. And I believe that's our only clean sheet in the league so far. And certainly looking at the manner of the collapse against West Brom and the manner of the goals that we conceded, it did feel like we just lacked that leadership figure, that person who's going to just calm things down and get everyone else organised and stop one goal turning into four as it did in the end. Because without O'Shea, I look at that back three and the wing backs and everyone else in the team, and I don't know who's kind of like standing there and taking charge when things start to go wrong. Is it Liam Moore? Is it Chris Gunter? Is it Sam Walker? I'm not too sure, and Reading will do really well to kind of find someone who can play that role.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at the goalkeeper is a relatively inexperienced, new at the club goalkeeper. You look at the midfield, John Swift, Bakuna, Ezatalahi. I mean, I'm not even sure Ezatalahi can speak English, bless him. Bakuna and Swift, I don't see them being particularly vocal. So I think the onus is kind of on Liam Moore. But as you say, there's Chris Gunter, Yadov's been a captain at Barnsley. So we've got players in there who can take charge. And the person who should be taking charge, let's face it, is Paul Clement. And that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the recap, is kind of Paul Clement. And to an extent, the leadership of the club. Ron Gourlay has continued to get a lot of criticism over the weekend with the defeat. Paul Clement, before we get onto it, I want to say what he said after the game. And he said that the goals we conceded were not so much for tactical reasons, but more for mistakes. We could have done a lot better, which kind of me stacks a little bit of a, wasn't my fault, mate, not tactical reasons. Anyway, he said, today's a strange feeling because ultimately, we're on the back end of a 4-1 defeat, which is not easy to take, but at the same time, it features some of the best football we've played. Kind of not arguing with that. We have made a step forward since the last international break, and we have to do the same in the next block of games as well, which is, again, something that I'm not going to argue with him saying. I want, if both of you can give me an answer to this, Matt, if you want to go first, is his job under threat now? Because the club took quite a while to sack Yap Stam. He was 1-18 when he got sacked, and Paul Clement isn't on that kind of run. Yeah, he's on a bad run, but not that bad at the moment. So do you think that his job is really under threat at the moment?
I think his job is under threat. We're hovering just above the relegation zone at the moment. The fans, there's discontent within the stands. You can see that within the numbers turning up at the ground. But whether that actually translates to the board level, and there's discontent there, or they're just happy for us to plod along, like you say, with one win in 18 with Stan, if that's the standard we're setting, then Paul Clement has absolutely nothing to worry about at the moment.
Is that a good thing, though? Do you think that he should? Because that's a pretty low bar.
It is a low bar, but fans call for time. They want managers to be shown time. But equally, it is a results business, and it will be a massive, massive blow if we go down to League One.
Sim, where do you stand on the Clement in or out?
Obviously, results aren't good enough at the moment, but to be honest, I've seen enough, even on Saturday, to suggest that we are making steps forward. I know the second half was dire, but to get into a position in the first half, in the first place, where we're playing, as Clement says, some of the best football that we've played this season, if not in quite a while, that shows there is some kind of improvement. There's not going to be immediate improvement overnight. We're not going to suddenly start winning games 4-0, 4-1 or anything, but I think we could be looking back on this in a couple of weeks or a couple of months and looking back on it as if it's the building blocks of something better, to be honest, because some of the things we did do on Saturday and we've done at Brentford and at home to Hull as well, and obviously getting the win at Preston, it is a lot better than what we have been seeing. Change doesn't come immediately, and certainly we need to start picking up some wins. I know we've got Millwall and Birmingham coming up as games we really need to highlight as wins, and based on the last couple of weeks, I think we're capable of doing that. Time will tell if he can manage that. Be a lot easier if he can get John Daddy Bodvarsson back fit, but if he does, I'm not ruling him out.
Does Paul Clement know his best team? No one has known Reading's best team since, I don't know, the playoff final a couple of years ago almost. But if you look at how Sims, Swift and Blackett can't get consistent game time, despite them playing relatively okay, Clement doesn't want to turn to youth. He's kind of picking horses for courses teams as well, which, you know, I'm not going to complain about. It's worked quite well for the first half against West Brom at least. But then Clement comes out and criticises himself in the media quite often. So he needs to work that out quite clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at the squad in general, there's no kind of, with a few exceptions, there's not many standout players in terms of quality. There's no one or two absolute stars or five or six stars that have to be starting week in or week out, week in, week out. There are certainly some players, though, that have got a lot better this season. John Daddy Bodvarsson with his goal scoring. Ilori's done well at the back. Andy Yeardom has done well too. And I can imagine that we will kind of slowly learn more and more about what our best team is over the next couple of weeks. I think we've settled on probably our best midfield three, with Bakuna, Ezitalahi and Swift. But it's going to take a little bit of time to properly work out what our absolute best team is. And yeah, we're going to have to change things around a bit. If we go to another team that, say, play three at the back, we might have to match them up in that sense. But and short of bringing in some really good players in January, kind of splashing the cash and really going for it in the transfer market, I don't really see us having any easy answers to working out what our best team is. But that is the kind of thing that kind of comes with trial and error and just working out as you go.
Injuries have been a big factor, Matt, as you were talking about earlier, Bodvarsson not being fit, obviously Baldock as well. You can even go to someone like Obita. O'Shea's not been in the team since his, with his, you know, suspension, etc. as well, has had an impact. Is the claim of injuries are holding us back enough to save Clement his job for a little while longer than would otherwise be possible?
I don't think it's really enough for him to fall back on and say that injuries are a major factor. But you can't dispute that having Bodvarsson out, a striker in red hot form, won't impact upon results and performances. But really, have we shown enough in terms of performances to be able to say that those would have been better with the injured players? Potentially not. Like you say, McNulty had that chance, could have taken it. The run he made in there behind, would Bodvarsson have made that run? Naturally, probably not. McNulty looks to get in behind. So it's another option that we've got. We've used it. He just hasn't been clinical enough in that situation.
My last point before we move on to news bites and into the quite a long mailbag, for those of you who are wondering if your question's getting featured this week because there were so many, yeah, we're going to have them in. But Juan Gourlay has kind of been the fall guy for a lot of people for some time now, and after the 4-1 result, a number of people, including Charles Watts, the former Get Reading journalist, and some other journalists as well, and a lot of fans, obviously, fingered Juan Gourlay as really the one who's kind of been turning this club from whatever you thought it was before to whatever it is now. But my question, as I've discussed on the podcast for a number of weeks, is what can we actually say that is definitively proving this? It seems to me, when it comes to the Gourlay stuff, the intra-club politics is kind of defining it all. There's a lot of blame shifting. I think Gourlay, when he spoke to the media a few weeks ago, shifted the blame away from himself. When Tevreden went, there was an article in Get Reading, which basically could have been written by Tevreden himself, saying that Tevreden wasn't for fault for any of the bad things, even though he still signed Sandro Weiser, which, you know, can't have one or the other, can you? And obviously there's Paul Clement, who's saying that he can't pick a team sometimes, and he's also saying that this mistake's not tactical reasons, the problem being with for the West Brom game. No one's willing to take responsibility, it sounds like, Sim. So does getting rid of Juan Gourlay help that and put the emphasis on someone else? Or, you know, how does it work? What does getting rid of Juan Gourlay necessarily do?
There's certainly a toxic feeling building up at the club at the moment. As you say, that Get Reading article, it did say that there are a lot of problems with staff behind the scenes going and not being properly replaced. There's not enough communication, apparently, between people like Tevreden and Gourlay as well. And that's just boiling over at the moment. And you saw it in the match as well. In the last couple of minutes, fans chanting things like sack the board and we want Gourlay out. And there's just a real sense, seemingly inside and outside the club, that there's just a bad atmosphere, and essentially the ethos of the club is going, essentially. That's what it feels like. And maybe that's a fair comment, maybe that's not. I'm sure Juan Gourlay would say something very different to that. But when you have a feeling that strong, and it becomes so strong that the fans start chanting it at an away game, then it becomes essentially true, whether it is or isn't. That feeling builds up, and that's I think just as powerful as something that is definitively provably true.
You know, I've only ever actually been to one Reading game from memory in all my years where there's been chanting for, I mean, I've never heard sack the board. I heard Rodgers out once at QPR away when we lost like 4-1 under Rodgers. It's the only time I've heard, as far as I can remember, a manager to be sacked as fans chanting. It's not something we typically do at Reading, Matt, and it shows that it's, you know, things get quite bad when it gets to that. But a lot of the problems, a lot of the things that I've heard people saying, be it on Twitter or Facebook, whatever, is that the Chinese owners need to, you know, install some authority and take control of the club and move it into a direction, whatever direction it is, preferably the one that we all want. That's, in putting Juan Gourlay in, they've done that, haven't they?
That was their intention, I believe. However, I think there's been so many bad reviews coming out of Reading, with former players coming out recently. I think McEnough came out this week saying that things aren't good at the club. There have been a lot of staff members as well, a high turnover of staff members that have been at the club for a long time. And if this is treated as any other business, you'd be looking at it going, why are these people leaving now there's a new CEO in place? I think one thing the fans really want is just a line of communication and some level of accountability as well, because that lack of accountability at the top is translating itself down onto the pitch. Like Sim mentioned earlier, the fact that we're falling apart, well, not falling apart, that's probably a bit of an over-exaggeration there, but the fact that O'Shea's omission this week has led to us conceding two set pieces, you can see the translation of the lack of accountability at the top and how it overflows onto the pitch and reflects there.
It's a good point to make, and I think that, as you know, as we said, the lack of anyone taking responsibility is something that runs from the top to the bottom. So, you know, I think this is just something that's going to run and run. And then Reading going down, it's certainly going to spruce up again and continue. And if Reading stay up, unless they can, you know, become a mid-table team overnight with Danny Loader, the favoured local son, scoring 20 goals a season, fans are probably still going to question the identity almost no matter what. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on it on the Tylerson podcast. I'm certainly not a massive advocate for Gawley. I'm kind of playing devil's advocate to a large extent, but purely because I do just think that with the way the club is run at the moment, it is so hard to know exactly who is making what decisions, exactly why those decisions are being made, and at the end of the day, exactly what's going on with the owners. A lot of people talk about the owners. The bottom line with the owners for me at the moment is that the cash seemingly is still there. So, you know, let's take that as one thing that we know and move on to the next part of the podcast, and that will be News Bites.
The Tylehurst End Podcast.
By Reading fans, for Reading fans.
So a quick rundown of the periphery or central Reading teams, if you prefer, for the News Bites. Then we'll crack on to Mailbag. Under-23s, they are 6 unbeaten after beating Colchester 3-1 in the Premier League Cup. They also recently beat the Southampton Under-23 team 2-0 in Premier League 2, so they're 4th in that table, 4 points from the top, with obviously promotion on offer to the Premier League 1 of the Under-23s league. Under-18s, they are in the top Premier Division. They, however, lost 7-0 at Fulham on Saturday, so they're 7th. Of 12 in the Premier League table. However, they did beat Southampton 2-1 in their own Premier League Cup, so a cup progression for both U teams. And finally, the women's team are currently 4th in WSL1 after 4 games. 1-0 was the scoreline away to Liverpool recently. Their most recent result, a good win there after a defeat at home to Birmingham. They next play on the 21st of October, with it being an international break at the moment. So that game is only against Arsenal, who are top of the league. So if you're keen on supporting the girls down there, that is a huge game to keep an eye on. And we'll be doing that on the Tylehurst End. So let's get on to the mailbag then. And as I count it, we might be into double figures for questions.
Get social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
at the Tylehurst End
and facebook.com/the Tylehurst End.
To kick us off, I'm going to bring in two questions at once. The first one from Matthew Everson. What's the point anymore? Are we forever stuck with a useless board bringing in players who don't care? And Breaks asks, what should I drink to forget that game? It was painful. Sim, preferred drink to forget a game? Go.
Oh, gin and tonic.
Very middle class of you, Sim.
Exactly. It's nice and healthy, or at least healthier than other things. Certainly. Yeah, it's my drink of choice on an away day.
Yeah, it's a very Reading drink, that gin and tonic. Matt, what about you?
I'm going to go for a pint of cellar just to counteract Sim there.
Yeah, bring a nice working class balance back into the show. That's good. I like that.
Definitely.
I think I'd, I don't know, just a shot of Sambuca, a medicinal sort of drink, almost Sambuca feels like. Ben Greenwood asks, Mannone or Walker? I've not been impressed with Walker's ability to deal with crosses. He got lucky versus Brentford, caught out versus West Brom, but Mannone is not without fault this season either. And this is a pretty pertinent question from Ben, a friend of the show, has been on a few times as well. Because Walker, Matt, I'm not seeing that he's the prodigal son. And yes, he's a young keeper. He's got quite a lot of talent about him. He certainly can stop shots, but for a goalkeeper that physical, you would expect him to be perhaps a little better at dealing crosses.
For me, Walker really hasn't done enough to stake a claim as why he should be number one. Yes, he's done fine. The mistake yesterday against West Brom for the first goal, looking a bit suspect. You can see why he's come out of League One. There's ability there, but possibly only as a backup goalkeeper in this division. Had Mannone done too much wrong before he was left out? Don't think so. So for me, I think I'll be bringing Mannone back in. He's got that experience as well. He's played with the back four before. There's more of a relationship there. We don't have to go through that teething process of Walker getting used to the back four and the back four getting used to Walker. Having that level of trust between a back four and the goalkeeper's a real massive bonus for defence as well.
Sim, are we going to have to just accept as a club that we have been spoilt for goalkeepers for a number of years now? And at the moment, we just have two championship quality goalkeepers.
Yeah, I guess so. None of them have really kind of jumped out yet. But in their defence, we do have two decent goalkeepers who can compete for that position. You go back to last season where Vito Minone was kind of doing okay for most of the season and then suddenly got dropped for Antti Jokola towards the end of the season. And it just felt like we'd just kind of like panicked and done anything, to be honest, because Minone wasn't great, but Jokola was certainly not any better, probably a lot worse. So having a number two, essentially, or competition in the shape of Walker, who's a lot better than Jokola's, I think it done us pretty well so far and will prove to be a good decision in the long run. But at the end of this season, you're looking at people like Lewis Ward and Luke Southwood as well in the long run, who can hopefully give a bit more competition and really stake a claim as well, because we do have some very talented goalkeepers at the moment. I imagine that one or two of them will leave because there is a lot of competition in our kind of like our youth level for goalkeepers coming through at the moment. But in the future, I do think that the long term is bright for Reading goalkeepers. Again, there does seem to be another healthy crop of very talented goalkeepers over the next couple of years. You've got Southwood, Ward, Adam Desbois, who's at Hartley Whitney at the moment, I think, Jokel Anderson as well, George Legg. So hopefully see one of them emerge and become a really talented goalkeeper for us.
Save us some money as well, because you can imagine Minone and Walker both on championship goalie quality wages. And, you know, if we have a youth player backing up one of them, then it, in theory, does trim a little bit off the wage bill as well. Louis Burton asks, Neil Warnock will get sacked sooner rather than later. Would we take him? And then he's saying he's going to grab his tin hat for the inevitable responses to that. And Christopher Cordery, I've had to, because I can't be asked to get the bleeper out for the editing, I'm going to have to change some of the words here that he's put into the tweet. Do you think we need a manager, not a coach in charge? And all these changes at the top end is to do with that bloke since he walked in, okay, Gourlay. We have been really smelly, so when does that smelly man go? Mind my French, or don't worry about that, Christopher. I've sorted you right out. And Matt, the question of Warnock, it's, if we replace Clement, do we go for a McCarthy slash, or Mick McCarthy, that is, slash Neil Warnock slash Steve Bruce type character? Someone who is a bit more experienced, perhaps commands a bit more authority, won't be playing the expansive football, bit more defence first. Is that something you settle for?
That sort of appointment is looking the most likely at the moment. It's an appointment that is going to be born out of desperation, I think, the way this season's heading at the moment. We've shown flashes and glimpses here and there with good performances against West Brom in the first half, flashes against Brentford as well, but we haven't really put it together in 90 minutes. And if we carry on not getting the results, but looking like we're doing the right things, it's going to get to a stage of the season where we need to start getting the results. And we're going to have to start playing percentage football that the likes of Warnock can bring in and implement quickly. He worked wonders at Rotherham. Honestly, a miracle worker. How they stayed up that season is beyond me. But if he can do that at Reading, if he were to take over in a similar position, would I take him? Yes. Would I want him there next year to watch 46 games of Warnock ball? Probably not.
Yeah, it's a good point about the short-term slash long-term solution. And Sim, the other day you told me that someone, a young, sort of hungry League 1, League 2 up-and-coming manager coming in would be a good idea, and your preference, should I say. But to me, that just seems, at the moment at least, a little bit too risky.
I think at the moment you just need someone who's going to freshen things up, to be honest. You look at someone like Clement, I still think, despite the problems that we've had on the pitch this season, he's still a tactically intelligent manager. He's a bright guy who will probably go far, but he's not a motivator. He's not someone who's going to come in and lift the players, lift the club, lift the fans as well, and get everyone kind of off their seats and really give us hope that things are going to get better. That's what I want from Reading's next manager, whether it's whether that comes in the short term or the long term. And I look at someone, say, like Nathan Jones at Luton, look at the attractive football they're playing and the connection between the team and the fans that they've got. And I just want that at Reading, to be honest. Just going back to Neil Warnock, actually, I looked at one of our old town ends, talking to a Cardiff fan. I think this was last December, talking to him about the impact that Neil Warnock had had on the club in general when he came into Cardiff. And he said it wasn't just about the results on the pitch. It wasn't just about being able to get wins and push them up the table, but he had an effect on the whole club. He gave the whole place a lift. He restored that link between the team and the fans that hadn't been there in the last couple of years at Cardiff. They'd very much kind of stagnated in the couple of years before he came in under, I think it was Paul Trollope, and they just kind of slid from a Premier League team down slowly down the Championship table and looking more and more mid-table. But when Warnock came in, the whole club got a lift on and off the pitch, the general vibe of it. And if he does become available, that's the kind of impact that we need. We do need that revitalisation, that energy, that real sense that there is a or can be a connection between the fans and the team. And that's really gone missing recently. If we can get it back, then we've got every chance of getting back to where we were.
I tell you what, Neil Warnock would probably be one of my top five preferences for interviewing someone on this podcast to get into the nitty gritty of his clashes with Reading over the years. I think would be really entertaining. So maybe if he becomes manager, that's something that might become more likely. Who knows? Let's move on then. Graham Scragg asks, is our inability to play well for 90 minutes a physiological issue, fitness issue? I think it means psychological issue, fitness issue, or combination of both? Yeah, that's kind of explained further by Chris Hartley with his tweet, explained further into that. He's saying that Tim Deller on BBC Barks suggested that even though Reading were beaten against West Brom and QPR the weeks, some individuals played well. Chris's concern is that this squad never functions well as a collective, in part through constant chopping and changing, but also because the recruitment was scattergun. That's why I feel we have a tendency to play as a group of individuals more often than not and crumble like we did versus West Brom in the second half. And I think that kind of neatly sums it up. In terms of the fitness issue, Windermere Dave asks, why do we get so many injuries in training and even warming up? And Matt, where do you stand on the injury things? We always think that our club is always the worst affected by injuries no matter what, because let's face it, I couldn't tell you how many injuries Preston or Ipswich have at the moment. It just feels like Reading have a lot.
I think it probably is a victimisation of the club itself, where fans do perceive that their club gets more injuries than others, when in reality that's probably not the case. But like we discussed earlier, Bod Farson going out in the warm-up at the last minute, that's a real blow. In terms of match preparation, things will have been set up to revolve around Bod Farson, then having to come in with changes at the last minute, it really throws your preparation out. So for that QPR fixture, we would have set up throughout the week to get to a stage where we're set up for QPR, and then that's been thrown out the window at the last minute. So in that respect, I can see why Dave is just so frustrated at the injuries.
Yeah, I do think it's a frustrating point, the injuries, isn't it? Because especially when they're happening in training, as Dave points out, there's no sense of, you know, if it's a bad tackle in a game, you say, oh, it's their fault, it's Chris Wiggott's fault that Dave Kitson got injured or whatnot. If it's in training, or especially in the warm-up, it is, you know, there's no one to blame and apart from the club itself and what's going on. And that feels, I think it leaves fans feeling quite helpless, which it certainly feels like at the moment with, you know, Bod Farson and Baldock and whatnot. Next question then is Michael Kearns, and he asks, is Bod Farson underrated? Now, Sim, there are some names here, Bradley Dack, Timu Pukki, David McGoldrick, all of which have been so highly praised in the media around the Championship this season. none of them have scored as many goals as John Daddy Bodvarsson. Only Neil Maupay of Brentford and Dwight Gale of West Brom, with a bit of helping hand from ourselves, it must be said, have scored more than Bodvarsson. Is he underrated?
Yeah, he is, but not just for his goals, to be honest. It's his all-round play, his ability to hold the ball up, to lead the line well and bring others into play. And although Maite kind of has some similar qualities in terms of his strength and his ability to win aerial balls, he's not got that same all-round presence that John Daddy Bodvarsson has. And I think we really missed that against QPR and against West Brom, particularly in the second half when we couldn't quite get the ball up the pitch and have a target man to keep it. And it's that kind of presence, that kind of impact that John Daddy Bodvarsson gives you. Sure, the goals are great, and it's good to have someone consistently putting them in, but in any kind of football system, you need someone who's going to be a focal point and give other players something to work with. And that's something we really need back.
With 47% of Reading's goals, I don't think there's any team, or statistically speaking, it looks like there's no team that relies on one man as much as Reading, apart from Brentford and Maupay, who's got 50% of their goals. But 47% of Reading's goals, that really is a big impact to be losing when he's not in the team. And kind of, as we said, at such short notice for QPR, you can understand to an extent, only to an extent, why that would put the team off. Christian Frank asks, if given unlimited funds for an event to improve relations between the board and the fans, what would you propose? With everything fractured, I know the best way to fix things is on the pitch, but I'd be interested to see what people want and not just a goodbye Gourlay party. And similarly, James Spalding asks, if you were the owner of the club and could only do one thing to try and reverse this downward spiral, what would you do? Now, the idea of an event to improve relations between the board and the fans, I think I'd go for something along the lines of a popular Reading FC fans podcast being allowed to host an event in which fans and players and also maybe board members could sort of mingle a little bit more. I think that it's a bit basic thinking, oh yeah, let's go and meet and have like a fans open day. I honestly can't imagine the last time, or can't remember the last time there was a fans open day. Obviously, you know, Star have the fans forum. They had one with Paul Clement recently. But any kind of press conference structure, I think, is going to be kind of limited depending on the personality. You know, Brian McDermott always gave brilliant ones, but Yap Stam, Nigel Atkins, not so much. Just that face-to-face interaction would be good. So Matt, what sort of things do you think that the club can realistically do to sort of bring the fans in a bit more and open those communication lines?
I think the stuff that Star do recently with Paul Clements, absolutely fantastic. It's an opportunity for us to ask our questions and for him to then counter that with why he's doing things and why things are, and the day-to-day operations at the club as well. So really, we just want, as fans, to have a line of communication with those in charge of running the day-to-day operations. And instead of hearing kind of politicians' answers and diversions of questions, deflections. I think Courtney Friday on Twitter the other day was getting a bit irate at Gourlay and his lack of kind of answering questions directly, for want of a better word. But just having that kind of opportunity where we can ask the hard questions that we want answered and for them to answer them honestly within a scenario or setting where things won't turn too toxic, as it were.
Yeah, and Sim, about 11 or 12 years ago, Reading FC gave the opportunity for one fan, I believe they had to pay some amount of money in a charity auction for this opportunity, to come off the bench in the Didcot Town friendly in pre-season for the last 10-15 minutes. Do you think something like that, I mean, that sort of links in with the whole like number 13 Reading fans everywhere. Just little bits like that, just to be a bit more grounded as a club. And I think if there's, as James asked, if there's one thing the owners could do, it's just to bring that sort of, it's, identity is an easy word to use, but bring that grounding, that sort of local aesthetic back to the club.
I think stuff like that helps. Certainly when things on the pitch are going well, but most importantly for me, you just need honesty and kind of direct communication from the owners. Fans don't expect an awful lot. They don't expect Dai Yonggei and Dai Julie to do a pop duet and release it on iTunes or anything like that, or
I
do anything
the opposite of that.
They don't expect anything grand or over the top. They just want direct, honest communication between the owners and the fans, and a general sense of where the owners want the club to go. You even got that from Anton Zingarevich. I know he obviously didn't turn out well in the end, but he talked to the fans. He addressed them directly, even if it was just appearing in a club-run media release kind of thing. Just that line of communication is really appreciated by people, and that's something that the club can do quite easily. They could say, you put out a call on Twitter or Facebook or their website for fans to submit questions to the owners, take them in and have the owners address them. And even if it's just putting them out in a video or a press release on the website or whatever, just as long as there is a sense that the owners understand what the fans are going through, understand what the fans think, and are prepared to talk about them directly. It doesn't have to be over the top. It doesn't even have to be with a huge amount of scrutiny. We don't need to have a hard-hitting interview with them or anything like that. Just straight, honest, direct line of communication. Bring that back and the fans will appreciate it a lot.
I think one thing that I do have to commend some of the players for, actually, with kind of in lines of communication, is David Myler turning up in the stands for the Brentford game. I think that's one thing he's done really well to build bridges with the fans, especially as a new player, and his use of social media as well, and his just general interaction with the fans as well makes him far more relatable. I don't know what your opinions are on that, guys. It's something that's really impressed me off the pitch with David Myler.
Yeah, with David Myler, it's an interesting one because he's, for those who don't follow him on Twitter, he's always playing FIFA and talking and posting videos of his Ultimate Team and whatnot and inviting fans to play him. And as you say, he's quite often, or certainly a few weeks ago, he replied to a number of tweets sort of having a go at him, basically. And it's something that he doesn't have to do, and it is appreciated. I remember when Lucas Piazon was having a go back at fans after he left for Fulham. And I don't mind either way if players are going to get aggro with ex-teams fans, or if they're going to come out and give straight and honest answers to fans' questions. I think just any kind of interaction and communication is appreciated to some level. I remember Royston Drenter actually invited a bunch of fans around on Instagram for a game of FIFA a couple of years ago. But these things, I think they help to an extent. I think when it comes to individual players, a lot of fans don't go on Twitter. We have to remember that. A lot of fans don't always get to see these sort of things. And that's why the club, I think it is important that the club leads the way. And it just doesn't feel like we're quite seeing that at the moment. We'll bring to an mailbag then with the final point that's tweeted into us from Shane Keane. It says, I could go on all day about how bad this club is run at the moment. Just two questions. Gourlay in or out? Clement in or out? And what is your take on the overpaid players? Now, I'm sorry, Shane, but that's three questions you've asked there. So I'm only going to answer two of them. We've covered a bit of Clement. I mean, Gourlay in or out, as we've kind of said as well. We've kind of covered that so far in the show. And overpaid players. Sim, what's your take at the moment on the kind of wage structure of the club? Do you think that the signings that we're making, Aluko, Baldock, to an extent someone like O'Shea maybe, these are players that are reasonably considered to be on reasonable wages. Do you think that that's a problem at the moment? Do you think that it feels like the club is spending too much on wages?
I just don't know what the plan is at the moment, to be honest. You go back to, say, that summer of 2016 when it was kind of Tevreden and Stam and Nigel Howe recruiting players, and there was obviously a clear sense of don't try to spend too much on wages, bringing in people like Beer and Vandenberg, Visa. There weren't many kind of big outlays on well-known domestic players, people like Aluko coming in for a couple of million, similar thing with Bakuna and Baldock and other players that we've seen in the last year or so. And I don't know if that just creates a sense of unbalance in the squad, because there's some players there who have come through the academy who have really kind of worked up to it, other players who are more on the way down in their career a little bit later on, more kind of the experienced players who are coming towards the end of their career, and other players like Bakuna and Aluka as well, who we spent a lot of money on. And it does just feel like an imbalanced kind of incoherent squad in terms of how it's been built up, and that's not the kind of thing that you can solve in one transfer window or two. It's going to take perhaps a couple of years to sort out properly.
Yeah, and I wonder if Matt, you, what your take is on this. To open up the question a little bit further, do you worry about the financial state of the club? Because I would suggest that this is almost a unique period, relegation pending, or barring any relegation, I should add, that we're currently in a period of Reading FC being relatively comfortable financially, with owners who seem to be suggesting that they're putting money in, be it for a training ground, be it for Sam Baldock, or what have you. And as a result, I don't know, does it feel a bit complacent that because we're not fighting for our financial future every season, that we just kind of, you know, take our eye off the ball?
I do think, the impression I get is that we are relatively comfortable financially having the Chinese owners. That is a blessing that shouldn't be underestimated, having gone through the Zingarevic era as well. We may not have been fighting relegation as fiercely at the time, but there was a point where we were in deep financial trouble. So the fact that we are able to still bring in players like Sam Baldock, who only just got promoted to the Premier League a couple of seasons ago on decent money. We've recently just handed out a new contract to Meite this week as well. So it definitely shows that there's money there.
4-year deal as well for Meite. That's a long time, isn't it?
Been a big talking point, hasn't it, this week, the 4-year deal for a man that's only scored one league goal. He's a young forward, and if we can bring him through and develop, and he's raw at the end of the day. He's got a real big aerial presence, and he can play out wide, he can play through the middle. I think he just needs a coach, really, just to kind of harness what's in him and get the best out of him. We saw Clement use him as a wide target man against Brentford, which was a real interesting one. I didn't think he'd go as direct as he did against Brentford and use Meite as a real wide target man. You could see Walker looking for him at every opportunity. So having that versatility is very useful, but the goals need to be there. And if you're asking some fans, a man that's only scored one goal, does he warrant a 4-year deal? Probably not. 2 years probably would have sufficed with an option of another year. I think if that was offered, most fans would have been more than happy with that, and there wouldn't have been any sort of furore on social media at all.
Now, that is seemingly one of the more tangible bits of evidence we have of the Gourlay impact, is that since he has come in, these long-term deals have been plentiful, shall we say, and it's quite hard to justify in some cases. Others, you know, if it's Liam Moore, John Swift, what have you, I'm not going to argue with it too much. Final point then I want to make on the finances is in relation to this show. And no, I'm not asking you for your own money on the Patreon campaign, as much as that's always open for you. It's that there's obviously going to be no show next week, but we will have a special interview with Adam Lafondre popping up on your newsfeed at some point over next weekend. And in that, there is some details on his exit. And if you remember, at that point, there was the tax man getting involved and potential winding up orders and all sorts of stuff. So that's a very interesting point that Adam discusses with the Tyler Sen to look out for next week. And after that, we've got some quite, you know, vital games. So we'll be discussing that in the final part of the show in any other business.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast. Read the blog on thetarlhurstend.com.
Right, the five games Reading have after the international break are Millwall at home, Birmingham away, Swansea away, Bristol City at home, and Ipswich at home. Sim, what is a reasonable haul of points from those five games?
About 10 points, to be honest. We really need to start racking up the wins. You're looking at Millwall, Birmingham and Ipswich in particular, teams that we have to beat, to be honest. I don't want to classify any of them as must wins, particularly if we manage to pull off a shock against Swansea City, for example. But these are games that you have to start winning. If you just start moving up the table, we're more than capable of doing it, as we've shown against Hull and Preston. But the players need to be on it. They need to turn up and take responsibility. And if they do, there's no reason why we can't beat those teams. And even looking at a very difficult trip to Swansea, who have, I think, been pretty dangerous this season, and Bristol City, who obviously present their own problems. Those are teams that we can give a good game to as well. Looking at the first half against West Brom, if we can build on that, take it into those two games, and obviously the three arguably easier matches as well, then there's no reason why we can't be looking at least three wins, if not maybe four, if we're being particularly ambitious.
Yeah, Matt, same question to you then. Swansea, 11th place, are the hardest team in terms of what the table is suggesting in that run of games. Otherwise, you're playing 13th, 17th, 20th and 23rd.
I think I'm going to be slightly more reserved than Sim. We've only got 9 points from 12 so far, so I think I'd probably take 7 points from those 5 games. I know that's not setting the bar very high, but I'd be more than happy with that, to be honest. We need to pick up points. If we can pick up wins against the likes of Millwall and Ipswich, that'd be fantastic. We're at home to both of those sides, so we really should be looking at least 6 points from there. A point away at Birmingham would be good as well. Can I see us getting anything out of Swansea away or Bristol? Not so sure.
Yeah, I think I don't know where I stand on this. It's so hard to look at these games with any kind of clarity, because you think, you know, 3 home games, win your home games, you're all right. But Reading can't win their home games. It's just not happening. And the 2 away games, arguably, when you look at the form of the teams, Birmingham, they've not lost in 6, winning 2 of those. Swansea, difficult team, not a ground that we've had much success at over the years. And it's hard, you know, to look at Bristol and Ipswich and think, oh, that's fine, we'll beat those two. It just doesn't work like that in my mind at the moment. So, you know, I think if you offer me 10 points, I'll snap your hand off. I think if you offer me 8 with the assumption of, or maybe even 7 again, as you say, winning 2, drawing 1, I think so long as you make sure that the wins are against the teams around you, it's probably just about okay. And the next question I wanted to ask on these games is, what changes need to be made to the team? We started with a 5-3-2 against West Brom. We looked very strong against Hull, with Baldock presuming he's fit out on the left and Bodvarsson up front. What do you do, Matt? What's the agenda for your picking your team?
I think I'd revert back to Manone in goal, dropping Sam Walker. That might seem a little bit harsh if it's based purely upon the West Brom mistake that he made. But I think Manone offers more than Walker. And then I go with a back 4. The midfield 3 with Clement seems to be fairly settled at the moment, with Azatalahi, Bakuna and Swift. And that would be my preferred midfield 3 as well. I think that's the most balanced midfield 3 that we've got. I've been impressed with Azatalahi and the way he protects the back 4, kind of shutting off the passing lanes, making lots of interceptions. Bakuna's looked a lot more confident to me this year, a little bit less petulant as well in his play. He seems to be more disciplined, just seems to be enjoying his football slightly more than he was last year. And then out wide, it's been a bit of a contentious issue with the likes of Aluko coming in when Sims has played well. Personally, I'd go for both Sims and Mo Barrow out wide. I think they offer kind of a real directness that Reading often lack when we're going forwards at times. And I think Mo Barrow has created 13 chances this season, which is the highest in the Reading side. So for me, I'd like to see him get a few more minutes as well.
You know, I think with Barrow, it's hard. He hasn't had an assist since the opening game of the season. And while it does kind of make sense to have Bodvarsson as the sort of target man to hit for a wide man getting the ball into the box, I'd be tempted to just go with that whole team and Baldock out left, Sims out right. And from then, if you want to play three at the back, you can maybe revert to it halfway through the game and try and drop Ezra Salahi, or, you know, play John O'Shea in the midfield and drop him in, or something like that. And from then on, Sim, I think it's a decent enough team to at least trouble those home games.
Yeah, that's true. But to be honest, I'd carry on with the back three. That same system that we had against West Brom, I thought it worked well all around, to be honest. The wing-backs seem more convincing than we have done in previous years, which helps a lot. Andy Yeardom did really well at left wing-back, actually. Something which we haven't had in recent years with, I know Blackett struggled there in the playoffs. Gunter wasn't quite so good in the playoffs, but even Gunter looked a little bit better at wing back against West Brom as well. And playing that system does just give you plenty of bodies at the back, that midfield three and a pairing up top as well. And particularly at the back, having three centre halves, I just think that allows us to bring in someone like John O'Shea and then, say, flank him with Ilorian Moore. That should be a lot more, hopefully, more secure if we can bring back in O'Shea without having to drop either Moore or Ilori, and then give Bodvarsson a partner, maybe perhaps someone like either Baldock or McNulty, gives us another option going forwards. I'm not too against playing Sims and Barrow, but I do just feel they're not quite as reliable, not quite as consistent as they're often made out to be. I know Sims is impressed from the bench a few times this season, but it takes a lot to translate that into a 90-minute performance. And I know we're crying out for him to start, and I've certainly wanted him to start more than he has done in the last couple of weeks, but there must be a reason why he isn't at the moment, because Paul Clement hasn't been picking him. He even picked Sonny Aluko over him for QPR, and you'd imagine that there is some kind of reason for it.
Look how it worked out.
Yeah, exactly. But with Barrow as well, again, he's a good player. He's a talented guy and he creates chances, as Matt says, but he blows hot and cold. And particularly when the game isn't really going for you and you struggle to get into it, then he can go missing a little bit. And I do just feel that relying on players like that, it can work. It can come up trumps, but then again, other times it doesn't.
I just feel with Sims, it sounds a little bit harsh to me that I think is only the one championship, maybe two, start so far. And that seems a little bit harsh from my point of view in a team that hasn't really got going in terms of creating from the flanks yet. So we'll see what Paul Clement wants to do for the Millwall home game. That is the first game back after the international break. I won't ask you guys for a prediction on it because it's a bit far away. I will ask you both to give me, however, a percentage score out of 10. Whether you're 6 out of 10 confident Reading can get a win, 4 out of 10 or whatnot. Before we do that, the prediction league is very straightforward to report on this week. Everybody got QPR wrong and everybody got West Brom right. So nice and easy, no points for QPR, 1 point each for West Brom. No one said that it was going to be 4-1. I had 3-1, so I was, you know, very disappointed. I think you did as well, didn't you, Sim? Very disappointed that that late goal went in. So Wim is still leading out in front of the pack for the prediction league. So Matt, then, what is your out of 10 confidence that Reading are going to beat Millwall?
Probably about 5 out of 10. We've only managed to beat Hull at home thus far. Millwall themselves haven't managed to pick up a win away from home yet, so that is our only saving grace. They've only managed to pick up 2 points from 6 away from home. So it looks like two teams that can't buy a win heading into the fixture. So really just hoping that the Royals can come out on top in that one.
Sim, can you beat 5?
Of course, I'm going to go with 10. I am absolutely completely confident
too optimistic
that we're going to do it. Confidence never lets you down as a Reading fan. You can never be too confident. You can never be too optimistic. I'm going to dial it up to 11 and be absolutely completely confident that we're going to win. And If it doesn't turn out, then so be it. But try going into it with a little bit of optimism, a little bit of confidence and positivity, and see if that pays off.
I think the last time I was both confident and optimistic as a Reading fan was as Liam Moore was stepping up to take his penalty at Wembley about 18 months ago. So I don't think I'm quite confident and optimistic. I'd say I'm relatively confident for this one because Millwall have struggled. They're not... I mean, historically, I can't think of the last time they actually came to the Medeski and put in a decent enough performance to come away with a point, let alone a win. So on that base, I mean, I think they beat us maybe last season or the year before, but that was it for some time. And I'm 8 out of 10 confident that Reading can win this game because there's been a lot... I'm not going to call it bluster, but I think there's been a lot of... It's kind of been the straw that broke the camel's back in a large sense is the reaction to the West Brom game. And I think my reaction to the QPR game is far more virulent than it was to the West Brom game because these things happen in football when you defend badly from crosses against a good team, they score more goals. It's more of an offence for me if you defend and attack badly against a weak team because that's when you should be, that's your bread and butter, that's when you should be picking up points. So we'll see if we get back to playing a weak team. We play like we did against West Brom, against Millwall, we should be okay. So let's see how we go. So that is the end of episode 171 of the Silas End podcast. All that's left for me to do is thank Matt, who is available at Panners and Nutmegs on Twitter. Thank you for coming on tonight, mate.
Nice and catchy. Thank you for having me.
And Sim, as always, thank you for popping along.
Anytime, anything to spread a bit of optimism and positivity onto the score prediction at the end, get everyone with a smile on their face going into a fun international break.
Yeah, and I'm not entirely sure this international break has come at the right time for Reading, but for Reading fans, as I say, I think the reaction to the West Brom game was pretty strong for what it necessarily really was, and that gives us all a nice two-week break to simmer down, look forward to 5 very winnable games, and at the end of the day, we'll come out of them with 5 wins and we'll be striding back up the table, or we'll come out of them knowing that what we thought going into them was exactly right and that maybe Paul Clement's time as Reading manager is up. Either way, we'll know, and that's sometimes good enough as you go into the international break. Thank you for listening, and come on, you arse.
You smile, funny how the crumbs always leave a trail.